This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. And today on the show, we've got Tony Garisco, former state senator, served in the legislature in the 70s and 80s, once lost a close race for Congress, and many of the same people he encountered on the hustings a few decades ago are out and about right now, Edwin Edwards, Mary Landrieu. And Tony Garisco got a degree from LSU, another one, in 2012. And that might be something we'll discuss. Should a college degree be a prerequisite when you run for high office? Also on the show, Katie Simpson Smith, who spends much of her time in New Orleans and has written a celebrated debut novel. It's called The Story of Land and Sea. We'll talk with her. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your local number. Outside the area, please dial 877-217-5757 toll free. And you may reach us via email, inkstershow@wrkf.org, and at Jim Inkster Show if you desire to tweet. Our first guest is Tony Garisco, the former state senator. He was three terms in the Louisiana legislature, succeeded and defeated by Governor Mike Foster many moons ago. And, of course, Governor Foster went on to become the leader of our state. But Tony Garisco, back in the 70s and 80s, he was on the cutting edge of many issues, including marijuana legalization at a time when that was heresy. And he actually got a bill through the legislature. How in the world did you do that?
How it happened, Jim, thank you. How that happened was there was a woman who was married to a doctor who had a 14-year-old son who was suffering from the after effects, the side effects of chemotherapy, and she testified, and her testimony was so powerful and so moving, it had a lot to do with getting that passed. And I don't know, it was one of those lucky times, but the law went, we were the second state in the union. Louisiana was way ahead of everybody before California, but it was never implemented, and today we still can't get that product for people.
And that was what year?
At 1987, 37 years ago.
87 or?
I'm 78, I'm sorry, 78, 37 years ago, yeah. Sorry.
297-5633 for Tony Garisco. Now, in 1976, we had the death of Jim Leslie.
That's right.
Ad man from Shreveport who was killed at the Prince Murad on Nicholson Drive right after Right to Work passed. People thought he was assassinated for different reasons than he was. He was assassinated. But at those times, the Capitol, in your first year there, it was an armed fortress, wasn't it?
Oh, it was. They were shooting real bullets then. It was a different time. That was big. That was high noon at the Capitol that day in that year. When Right to Work was passed, and the cover was that organized labor had done it because Jim Leslie had was the consultant for Right to Work. However, labor had nothing to do with it. It had to do with this fellow Dautoyes in Shreveport was behind it all.
Mm-hmm. And Jim Leslie was shot down at a formative time in his life in a public place, less than a mile from the Capitol itself. And Tony Garisco was a staunch Democrat, still is, in a state that has veered wildly red. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it started not in my time, but I think it started in it started when the South took the position with Nixon that they had a Southern strategy. And ever since then, after the Civil Rights Act passed and the Voting Rights Act passed, the South went, they showed their colors about, I think it was born in racism. I can't say it is today, but that's the way it went. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the Democrats were really conservative, and they just switched it over to the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when people ran for Congress in those days, issues like busing and welfare would be at the top of the list, race baiting, and it often worked.
Yes.
And you ran for Congress in 1980 and lost to?
Billy Tozan. Billy Tozen and Jim. And Billy Tozen was a Democrat.
Jim Donilon was in that race as well.
He was. Jim Donilon was in that race as well. Dave Treen support. He had just gotten elected, Dave Treen's seat. Dave Treen supported Jim Donilon, who had run for lieutenant governor and lost. And Edwin Edwards supported Billy Tozen. And I ran as a Democrat, but independent of that political support.
Now, what were your major issues when you ran for Congress 34 years ago?
Well, first of all, I remember it was something to do with being independent of the political forces of the time, which were really mild at that time. And I'd had several, I was pretty liberal back then, and I still am. Those issues got a lot of attention. I had just... they had the Edwards administration had put a punitive damages on the press, and that 1980 I got that removed. I thought that the self-promoting junk mail called franking from the ought to be reversed, and that the free mail ought to go to the citizens could have the free mail, and it was things like that. And I got endorsed by the New Orleans Times-Speaker Union, by the editorial board. Didn't get me elected.
But you got endorsed by
yes.
What was the largest newspaper in the state
at
that time. Garrett Graves, who was on this show last week and has raised more money than any other person running for Congress in Louisiana this cycle so far, he has a rather large piece of campaign literature that he's putting on doors, and I have one. And it says, if you think Obama is doing a good job, throw this away. Proven conservative problem solver. He's got the kind of experience we need to stop Obama's destructive agenda and get our country back on track. Garrett's priorities, restore our conservative principles to repeal Obamacare and stop the president's reckless agenda, promote smaller government and balance the budget, reduce tax rates and red tape, close the border and increase deportations, protect the coastline and sportsman's paradise, unleash the potential of our energy economy, defend religious freedoms, life, gun rights, military, veterans, and our constitutional rights, provide traffic and flooding solutions. Something there for every red-blooded conservative.
And then
more attacks on the president. Who is President Obama representing? It's not South Louisiana, and so forth, from Garrett Graves, who is obviously running against the man in Washington who was born in Honolulu in 1961. Will this work?
Oh, it's worked before. It's a poor piece. It's in print as it institutionalizes what we already have, the acrimony and the divisiveness that we have in this country, and it must play to the right people because they wouldn't keep saying things like that. And I mean, I don't know how many times they voted against Obamacare. What, 30 something? I don't know. Most of that's not even an issue. Most of the things that particular piece says, like gun rights, Louisiana has what's arguably the strongest gun rights in the Constitution, far surpasses the Second Amendment of the federal Constitution. I don't know what this guy's talking about. And then he was against the lawsuit by the levy board against the oil companies ravaging South Louisiana especially.
All right. He, in more literature, on the back page, says he's a member of Glock Support Shooting Foundation, Gun Owners of America, NRA. He's big on guns, and in Louisiana, you're right, that plays pretty well. Otherwise, candidates wouldn't constantly talk about how they like to fire their weapons. He did say on this show he's against the fairness ordinance. He also also indicated that he had not read it, but he said he was against it. And his piece says he will defend our constitutional rights. Now, some believe this fairness ordinance is a constitutional right. And by the way, I would bet that if you asked any of the other Republicans in the race for the 6th District, they would probably mirror Garrett Graves' stances on almost every issue.
Oh, I would think so. It's a catalog of probably just about all of them on there. There's another candidate that is in the race. Senator Claytor, I think he's a fine guy, but he was on this show. He had just voted against to stop the levy board from filing their suit. And he used an odd argument. He said, I voted against it because they don't have standing. Now, this guy used to sell law books, and he knows that standing is not determined by the legislature, but determined by the court or the judge who hears the case, whether or not a party has standing. And also, he forgot that the Louisiana Constitution has a section in it, the Bill of Rights, Declaration of Rights, of which I was a member of that committee in the convention, says the court shall be open. And you can't statutorily close them to a party. But this piece could have been picked up by most of them. I don't know enough about the young McKithen man, and I don't know much about the dance instructor in Homer.
The young McKithen man, who are we talking about?
Not McKithen.
Graves?
No, the
Dietzel.
Coaches.
Dietzel.
Dietzel. Yeah, we're mixing
that's
them
funny.
Up,
that's
Joe.
Funny. That's funny because in those days, John McKithen wanted to be the football coach, but he was not. But Paul Dietzel led LSU to glory in 1958. By the way, the last time LSU had an undefeated season, the Tigers are poised to have their first unbeaten season in 56 years and start Saturday in Houston as 5-point favorites over the University of Wisconsin. Yep. Dan downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on the air with Tony Garisco.
Yeah, so when you were in the legislature, was there anything akin to the Grover Norquist no tax, no matter what pledge, or ALEC dictating to the right-wingers the way to vote?
No, the only pledge we made was the oath of office.
Should the lawmakers take a pledge of this kind?
Absolutely not. That's just why I said that just now. You take an oath of office to uphold the Constitution of the United States and to uphold the Constitution and laws of the state in which you reside. And giving pledges to side nitwits and keeping a pledge and a promise to somebody who means nothing is ridiculous.
297-5633 is your number. And Louisiana has one of the lowest tax rates collectively. When you cobble all the taxes together in the country, that's another item that's been released this week. But people are averse to taxes. They don't like them, no doubt about it. What was the old Russell Long thing?
Oh, yeah, tax me, tax the man behind the tree. Don't tax you, don't tax me.
Yeah.
Tax the man behind the tree. Yeah.
There you go.
That was it.
And he was head of the Finance Committee in the Senate for many years and got elected over and over. And in those days, I think we had a warm and fuzzier view of government than we do today. And a story today, a column actually, in the New York Times from Frank Bruni. He says, in a NBC poll, 60% of Americans say that we are a nation in decline. Do you believe that?
I wouldn't say we're a nation in decline, but we really need to take a breath and cut all the stuff out about, as I mentioned earlier, about it doesn't matter what party you're in, what side you're on. It doesn't matter any about that. It's just not be so acrimonious and to be, like they said, disagree and come to some solutions and some compromises and some, we're all Americans. And that is going to have us take a dive. Now, what is noticeable and alarming is the gap in wealth from the top to the bottom is reminiscent of the 1920s when we had the trust busted and Standard Oil and Rockefeller and all those things. So that's scary.
Well, in the Wall Street Journal NBC poll that Frank Bruni cites, he says 49% of the respondents in this country say that we are in a recession right now, which we are not. 46% said no. 297-5633. Why is America having the mully gullies? We'll talk with Tony Garisco about this when we return in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Frank Barnett is producing. 297-5633 is your number, and Tony Garisco is the guest. Inkster Show at WRKF.org online. I mentioned that in a Wall Street Journal NBC News poll, 49% of the country says America is in a recession right now. 71% of the people think the country is on the wrong track. President Obama, despite some flaws that are apparent, as most presidents have flaws, he has presided over an economy that has seen the Dow Jones Industrial Average rise from about 7,500 today, as I look at it at this point, 17,123. It is more than doubled. We're obviously not in a recession. Why do so many people in this country think that things are going so wrong right now?
I don't know. Beliefs die hard. I wish, Jim, that you and I both, if we'd have had a little bit of money in the stock market on equities in 2008 and kept them in today, we would have a lot more money than we would have had then. As far as the economy, it's in great shape. I mean, what is it, 6.2 right now, unemployment? I looked up to see what is the sign of a healthy employment rate, which is
actually
really full employment.
It's 5.3.
Yeah. And so you subtract that, you're only 1 point off, because there's always movement in the employment.
That number may very well be skewed, and I think it is, Tony, because it does not include people who've just given up and have quit looking
for
work.
That's correct. You got to count that in. You do, and it's hard to see who those are. That's right.
All right. Leonard Joseph writes, the poor quality roads and planning tax our time, cars, insurance, tires, and upkeep. Our quality and accessibility to health care, healthy food taxes, our children are taxed, Louisiana and low taxes, a myth when viewed on a balance sheet. I think I know where he's going with this, but what about a cigarette tax? That's something Louisiana, I think, 36 cents a pack. New York State, it's $4.35 a pack at last count. It may have even gone up more since that report of a year ago. So that would increase the budget enough to avert all these cuts to higher education, every one of them, if Louisiana were at the level that New York State is.
That's a good way to look at it. Of course, there's a point where you get to be what we call, what's called confiscatory. That is, at what point where you just are so high that you're punitive. But we need the money for higher education. I remember we talked about marijuana, but one of the bills was that I passed with, I called Jim, who was the chancellor when you were in school?
Jim Morton.
Well, I asked him to go to the place one day, the restaurant, and met with
the place.
Senate station, Jack Staples, and Jack Staples. And anyway, I got him to agree, and he helped me pass the law that for eminent scholars endowment, which is now almost $400 million in the coffers of the higher education. But some of those are now unfunded. That is, the private money is up, but the public money is not. And I think we should fund that. That's one of the things we could do also for higher education. And the Steele plan was a mistake to get rid of. Governor Jindal had the right idea. He was not for it, and he got talked into it early in his career. But we would have a lot more money then. Also, LSU had its own endowment that I passed. It would be about $60 million now. It got repealed back in the early 90s.
297-5633 for former State Senator Anthony Garisco, who went back to college a few years ago, by the way, and became a member of the Student Government Association at LSU. this is a man who has several other degrees as a lawyer, and we'll talk with him about why he did this. Charlotte in New Iberia. Good morning, Charlotte. You're on the air with Tony Garisco.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Mr. Garisco. I am calling to ask, what do you think it would take for businesses and the people who create our laws to realize that we need additional taxes so that we can fix the crumbling infrastructure in each of our 50 states. Thank you, and I'll listen off the air.
Well, because people run on the program of no taxes, so they keep their promises because they won't even look at the issue. And you need to vote for people who say at least I'm not going to pass new taxes, but I'm willing to look at what can we do. And one of them, a place is, especially in Louisiana, it comes up all the time, but to do away with these exemptions. Keep in mind what a tax exemption is. The item or the product or the service has already been taxed. That is, they have a tax on it. But for whatever reason, usually by lobbying, that tax gets exempted from the product or service. That is called legislative grace. Remove the legislative grace when you need to, because you need the money, because that item has already been taxed. But when you want to reduce, when you want to take away an exemption, they call it a tax raise, which is incorrect.
Tony Garisco, 877-217-5757, wherever you may be, for the former state senator and lawyer and a man who is, as you can hear, still conversing on the issues of the day. And I mentioned going in that some of the people he encountered in the legislature as a member of the state Senate for a dozen years in the 70s and 80s, they're still out there. When you were in the Senate, right down the hall in the House was Mary Landrieu. She was elected in 1979 when she was all of 23 years old, moving straight from Delta Gamma to the Louisiana House. And she immediately made an impression and 8 years later was elected treasurer. But she's in for the fight of her political life.
Yes, she is in the fight for her political life. I remember when Mary was in the legislature and she was in the House and I was in the Senate, she asked me if I had an aide for the session. And I said, no. She said, would you consider I have a sister who is in LSU? And I had her for 2 years and she was a wonderful young woman. She's now a state district judge in New Orleans. But Mary, according to Nat Silver, who's pretty accurate, he calls that for the Republicans right now.
Yeah, although it's still...
It's very, very close.
But
and she's made her way out of all close races. Mm-hmm. So that you can't count Mary out, and it's going to be real tough.
Barry Irwin at Cable notes that Congressman Cassidy has agreed to be in the debate featuring Mary Landrieu and Rob Manus October 14th. This will be an LPB production, and so... the congressman, who has been reluctant to commit to many debates, will be in the Cable debate on the 14th of October, and we commend Congressman Cassidy for doing so. Mm-hmm. John in Lafayette. Good morning, John. You're on the air with Tony Garisco.
Good morning, man. What about an internet sales tax? That's a tax that exists but is not being collected. It was supposed to bring about $400 million a year to Louisiana if, in fact, it would be collected. What do you think about that?
Well, sir, I must admit that I'm not familiar with the internet tax. I think it would be a lot of resistance to that, too, because everybody's online now. But that might be something to really look at. If it doesn't have one, it have to be very mm-hmm. small, because the internet's now a commodity, just like gasoline is a commodity. That's another place where you could raise some taxes. I was just in California. They got a much larger tax in California to take care of their roads. And they got better roads than we have. But I don't know about the internet tax at all.
Well, it's something that may have to become a reality for these bricks and mortar stores to survive. They
yep.
pay taxes.
Yes.
297-5633 for Anthony Garisco. Edwin Edwards, he was governor of Louisiana four times, and during some of those years, you were in the state Senate. What kind of a governor was he?
He was a good governor as far as working with him with the legislators. He always kept his word. He was always available. He would talk to you and say where he was and what position he was taking and ask you if you could support him. And if you didn't support him, he wasn't... He didn't take out reprisals to my recollection. Incidentally, I got a little quiz. Can you name all of the political offices that Edwin Edwards held in his lifetime.
That Edwin Edwards held in his
lifetime. Yeah, you don't have to worry about how many times, anything like that.
Well, he was four times governor.
Yes.
He was elected to Congress, I think, three times.
Yes.
Okay. He was a city council person in Crowley.
Yes.
Right. And what am I leaving off?
Well, you know another one. He was state senator.
That's right. He was a state, very briefly. Very briefly before
yes.
he went to Congress.
Yes, so I know you knew that.
Yes.
Well, there's one that I thought you might not know.
Okay.
He held one more office.
What is that?
He was a state Supreme Court justice for one day.
For one day.
He signed a document, and he wanted to serve in all three branches of government.
Really?
Yes.
That is interesting.
So anyway, go ahead and ask your question about him. I just thought it would be fun this morning.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he says he's been on the ballot 26 times.
Wow.
In primaries and general elections. And of those 26 times, he says he's run first 25 times. The one-to-one loss was in 1987 to Buddy Romer. And he quite likely will run first come November 4th in the 6th District. But I think he's got some real challenges after that, Tony.
He will, and he'll have challenges. And this is what I don't understand. I understand that it's in his body to run for public office. What I don't understand, and I understand that he would want to win, and I understand he would like to take the oath of office, but I don't think that Governor Edwards, the former Governor Edwards, is going to want to serve. That's going to be brutal. He's been there before. He's going to be in a minority party. That's not going to be pleasant for him. It really wouldn't.
Well, if he goes, though, he'll be surrounded by all kinds of people who are interested in him.
Yep.
He will be the last member of the Greatest Generation, the last World War II veteran to serve in the Congress.
So, okay.
So I think he'd be okay with it. And
hopefully.
And then again, in Congress, they don't fire you if you miss votes.
No. But I can't see everyone ever sitting in those committee meetings all day long.
I can't either. But then again, a lot of younger people don't sit in those committee meetings.
Yeah.
I would imagine when Bobby Jindal was running for governor in 2007 as a member of Congress, he missed a few of those committee meetings.
I'm not saying that he wouldn't carry out his duties and responsibilities. I just was thinking from a personal standpoint how boring that might be for the man. I think he would do what he said he's going to do.
Yeah, it might even be more boring than a reality show. Now, Edwin Edwards, when he was on the skids politically, and nobody is more astute than he when it comes to analyzing when he's hot and when he's not, he would actually endorse candidates he wanted to lose. And that is no joke. I know he did it on a few occasions. And I see that Jimmy Swaggart has apparently endorsed young Paul Dietzel privately, has a yard sign out for him. Would that be something that young Dietzel should broadcast to the masses?
Well, I would imagine that there's Jimmy Swaggart has a following, not near the one he once had. So I guess so. That's interesting you say about Governor Edwards. He actually, I witnessed because he asked me, but I know he asked many hundreds of people. He said, in election season, he'd say, how do you want me to go? I will vote. I will come out for you if your district likes me. If you want me to be against you in the district, I'll do that. He would actually tell you that.
Really?
Yeah. That's the truth. Because he was helping you both ways. He figured he would do what you wanted.
Well, he was a political operative like nobody else. And for those who continue to insist that Edwin Edwards was a crook on a grand scale, on a one-on-one level, he may have been one of the most honest people to ever be in politics, and I think that has a lot to do with why he was so successful. If he told you he was going to do something, he either did it or then told you why he couldn't do it.
The difference between he and Bobby Jindal is one guy is authentic. And the other guy is not authentic, and he can't understand it. He flails away at getting noticed. Edwards is authentic, and everybody wants to be around him in his presence because the guy is real who he is. The other guy's got to pretend to be something else.
Who would think that Edwin Edwards would have a younger wife than Bobby Jindal.
Everybody would think that. That's possible. That's what he would say. Why not, Jim? He would say.
Well, he does. He does. In fact, if he wins this time, the wife he has now will be younger than Elaine was when they went there 50 years ago.
Oh, my gosh. That's interesting.
Yeah. So they're getting younger and younger for the
And of course they have to be she has to be younger than his daughters. So
much younger.
Yeah,
young enough to be their daughters.
Yeah, of course.
Their daughter. And I reminded him that if he'd gone 51 years in the opposite direction, his bride would have been born in 1875.
Whoa.
So he will be the centerpiece of attention if he is elected, but my guess is that he will not win a runoff, and that Garrett Graves or Dan Clater or Paul Dietzel will be the next congressman from the 6th District.
And I think that the former governor has that kind of resilience, and he would be okay with it.
Yeah, he went to jail for 8.5 years, losing a political race. That's not like saying guilty on 17 counts, is it?
Oh, no. No.
And remember, he took that, and he said he believed in the system, he served his time, and he came out, and he has not been bitter, at least publicly. I remember Jim Brady, the late, great Jim Brady, who died a few weeks ago and has now been classified, as it should be, as a homicide. They asked him if he was bitter, and he says, bitter is not classy, and I try to be classy. And I think Edwin Edwards has shown some class, and because of that, some people who were ardent opponents of his now say, you know, I kind of like this guy. He is a person who is resilient and is an example of the human spirit triumphing over adversity.
That's a good way of putting it. I think that's very accurate.
All right. Will in South Baton Rouge asks where medical marijuana is headed in Louisiana for people who need it.
Well, right now it's dead right now. I came out and testified in favor of the medical marijuana bill that was presented this year. I hadn't been around the Capitol in years. I just could not go. But they had the sheriffs and the DA sitting in the audience, and they were totally against it. And, you know, now they have an interest, because if they can keep people in jail, they get so much a day for the prisoners. And people who are picked up for those for drugs like marijuana are easy targets, and they make money off of it.
Mm-hmm. Why did you go back to school?
Went back to school because I wanted to. I have a love of learning, and I wanted to go back. What it would be like to go. A lot of people have it as a romantic notion, and I acted on it. And I went back to school and went to. I didn't want to take adult education. I wanted to get the real thing, and I went back and got a master's degree, and I had a great time. Mm-hmm. And I tell people, I said, you know, I was going to LSU when they won the national championship. And they said, yeah, 58. And I said, no, 03.
You may have been there both times.
Right.
And Tony Grisco, it's always a pleasure. Looks great. The Pilates are working.
Yeah, thank you.
And we shall return.
Have a good time.
In 90 seconds with Katie Simpson Smith. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and our guest is Katie Simpson Smith. She was born and raised in Jackson, Mississippi, has a PhD in history from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and an MFA from the Bennington Writing Seminars, and she's been working as a professor at Tulane University, and she has written a debut novel that has been celebrated throughout the land called The Story of Land and Sea. Good morning, Katie.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well. Where are you today?
I am in Jackson, Mississippi this morning.
Okay, so you're in your old homestead.
Yes.
Okay. Well, you're all of, what, 28 years old?
I am.
And already, Katie has been featured in Vogue. It says, Katie Simpson Smith left academia for a chance to write her own story, a luminous Revolutionary War novel, set to be the debut novel of the year. And it is called, as stated, The Land, The Story of Land and Sea. And you say coastlines are evocative. Why so?
I think coastlines, to me, provide so much room for looking at how the ocean and the land interact. So sometimes the ocean butts against the shore on a rocky coast, and sometimes it just sort of slides in through these beautiful marshes and swamps. And I think it speaks a lot to how we as humans interact with the landscape around us, whether we see it as adversarial or whether we're in more a happier relationship with it.
The story is set in a coastal town in North Carolina at the twilight of the Revolutionary War. I would imagine your background in history was essential to crafting this story.
Yes. So for my graduate degree in history, I studied the late 18th century, particularly the lives of women in this time period. For my dissertation, I wrote about motherhood in the South and looked at how white, black, and Native American women raised their children differently. So I'm moving sort of from that period and that subject matter to the same time period, but really looking more at fathers and about more holistic family relationships, which was very fun for me to do. But I could certainly draw on a lot of my research for my dissertation, which was ideal.
It's at the twilight of the Revolutionary War, following three generations of men and women whose land is crumbling. Rebellion in the air, allegiances are blurred, and life has a seize-the-day precariousness. It's a time that, because of your historical knowledge, has relevance to you, and you've brought it to life. Maybe a time that people in this country, all of us, should appreciate.
I certainly think so. And one of the remarkable things that I discovered as I was writing is that these emotions that seem very different to us because they're set hundreds of years ago are in fact still so relevant to us today. That while the circumstances of people's lives were a lot more difficult in many ways, particularly for the poor or for African Americans, they still have these emotions of love and of loss and of struggling to define themselves in a world that was often sort of working against them. So I hope that readers see the modern relevance in these historical characters.
And one of the principal characters is a slave girl.
Yes, and she was very challenging to write for me because I wanted to be responsible to the time period and to what her experiences would have been, but I also wanted to show her as a very strong actor in her own right, a woman who could fight against the system that she was caught within in order to pursue her own dreams as a human.
Katie Simpson-Smith is with us, a young writer on the go and on the move. You're quoted as saying, "These are people who are forging a new country. That leaves a lot of room for the novelist to step in and present them with possibilities."
Yes. I think one of the things that fiction writers love most is having characters caught in these sort of high-intensity situations. And for me, the end of the revolution is precisely that. You have not only families but also colonies and states who are struggling to figure out what their future holds, what independence really looks like on the ground level. And that allows the fiction writer to come in and say, okay, I want this character to react this way to the gap that's presented to them within their future. And it's very rewarding and exciting to write about.
Anita Shreve calls The Story of Land and Sea the best novel I've read all year. The writing is word perfect with its near biblical cadences. It's taut and relentlessly spare sentence, and its unusually wise utterances, all of which contribute to the sheer joy that come from finding oneself in an imagined universe that feels as real as a splinter in a finger. You like writing about women. Now, why so?
I do. I think I have a particular responsibility as a woman to represent the wide range of experiences that women have had historically. I think we have this idea that women in the past led fairly repressed lives, that they were confined to the home, and that they couldn't participate in the public sphere or in politics or economics. And my research has shown that, in fact, they've found ways to assert their own identity as women and to fight for some measure of control in their lives. And largely that came through the experience of motherhood. So this is a realm that women could actually control. And it wasn't always pretty, and it wasn't always something that they, you know, felt attached to or had any sort of instinct toward. But they could manipulate the situation of their own family such that they felt some sense of pride and self-worth. And I think that's very important for modern readers to sort of look back and understand that women throughout history have been fighting for that sense of control.
Mm-hmm. Next week, Katie will be in New Orleans at Maple Street Books on Wednesday of next week, and then Thursday at Octavia Books. You're making the rounds, going to a lot of different places, many in the South, discussing the story of Land and Sea. Are you heartened by the response you've had from your debut novel?
I am. It's all very exciting and a little bit overwhelming, but particularly unexpected. You know, writers are so attached to their own tiny spheres. You know, we write in our homes and usually by ourselves and often late at night. And it's hard to envision a future for whatever it is you're writing that involves, you know, a book tour or reviews. And so it's been just so surprising, and it makes me so grateful that people in America are still invested in literature to such an extent. It makes me really hopeful for books across the world.
Mm-hmm. How much time do you spend in New Orleans, Katie?
So I live there. I was teaching for the past 2 years at Tulane in their Newcomb Scholars Program, which is a wonderful program for women at Tulane that sort of teaches them research and leadership skills. But I'm taking a year off this year from that, but I'm looking forward to being back in New Orleans this year and just sort of exploring the city some more. There's so many things to discover there.
You are the daughter of professors, correct?
Yes.
Where were they teaching when you were growing up?
So they both teach at Millsaps College up here in Jackson, Mississippi. And it was wonderful having professors as parents because they place such a high value on education. And I always thought that I would follow in their footsteps. And so when I went to graduate school for history, there was this idea that, okay, I will be a history professor and you know, do what they do because it's so rewarding to them. Mm-hmm. But as I was in that history program, I slowly realized that the stories that I wanted to be telling weren't solely historical, but were also imaginative. And that's when I decided that I really wanted to pursue a degree in writing. And I never thought that it might be a serious career option, but I wanted to give myself the time to take myself seriously as a fiction writer. And I'm so glad that I did that.
The Vogue story describes your lake blue eyes, and at one point you flirted with the idea of going to Hollywood, didn't you?
Yes. So I was a film studies major in college and got very attached to filmmaking, so I wanted to be a director. So I went to Los Angeles for a summer and had an internship in Hollywood and took some directing classes at USC. But the whole Los Angeles vibe was just a little bit too overwhelming for me. But I still sort of make some movies on the side, you know, short music videos and documentaries and things mm-hmm. like that.
You left for college when you were 16?
Yes. That was a bit of a challenge. I was so eager to move on in the world and wanted to get out of the South at that point particularly. I thought there's this whole world beyond Mississippi that I needed to explore. So I went up to Mount Holyoke College for my undergraduate degree, which was such a wonderful experience. But it made me appreciate the South in a new light. And while I loved my time there, I realized that I was really a Southern person. And moving back here was the best decision I made.
And you spend much of your time in New Orleans, and now you're teaching young women who are a decade younger than you were when you went to Mount Holyoke. Have students changed in a decade?
That's a great question. One of the classes I teach them is the history of women in higher education. So I get to sort of tell them what women's college experiences were like from the mid-1800s up through today. And a lot of that is explaining what it was like when I was in college, and we didn't have Facebook or Twitter. And so they're different in the ways that they engage with technology and the way they see the world. I think they have a much broader and more mature understanding of the global community than I ever did when I was in college. And so it's really encouraging to me to see these young women who, you know, are poised to become the next leaders in our society. And I think, you know, I can't imagine better leaders that our country should have. So I'm very proud of them.
The latest work from a promising young writer, Katie Simpson Smith, is The Story of Land and Sea, a novel. And you got a big publishing house for your novel. That is an accomplishment in and of itself.
Yes. HarperCollins is publishing it, which is so marvelous, and I've been so grateful for their support with the project. When I was writing this, because it's historical fiction, it seems very distant, and it seems a little bit on the bleak side, although I think there's a lot of optimism in the book as well. So I just never thought this might be, you know, the kind of project a major publishing house would be interested in. I thought they wanted, you know, thrillers or books with vampires in them. So to have them support a book like this is very encouraging to me.
Mm-hmm. And you made note of it. You wrote a book called We Have Raised All of You, Motherhood in the South, 1750 to 1835. And you said that the experience was certainly different for mothers who were white and those who were black and those who were Native Americans.
Yes. There's a sort of wide range of experiences, not only in the resources that women had to raise their children, but also the attitudes towards child-rearing and towards motherhood. For instance, you have Native American mothers, especially among the Cherokee and Catawba, who viewed motherhood as a much more communal project. That motherhood meant not only raising your children, but watching out for other people's children, and also for raising crops and farming. Agriculture was a big part of the sort of maternal instinct. And then on the other hand, you have enslaved mothers who have virtually no control over their children's lives. These are children who could be sold from their mothers at any moment without warning.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they still find ways to carve out time with their children and find ways to teach them about the world that they will encounter. So they teach them about what slavery means, but also their own family histories to reinforce the fact that their children are not just slaves, but are in fact valued members of a family with a long history to it. So there are some really wonderful things that I found in my research.
Mm-hmm. I think I hear a cat in the background.
That's my cat, yes. He gets jealous when I'm on the phone.
Yeah, I read that the cat's named Eudora.
Actually, Eudora unfortunately passed away a couple of weeks ago, so this is her brother, George.
George.
Who misses her, yes.
George. Eudora was probably named after Eudora Welty, right?
Absolutely, yes.
And George?
Eudora Welty was
George?
George, there's a possibility that he was named for George Eliot, but he's a boy, so I don't think that works quite as well. But George Eliot is definitely another one of my favorite authors.
Well, I'm glad George is seeking your attention. You live in the South, a daughter of the South. Is it almost impossible, Katie, to live in these parts and not appreciate what happened here, good and bad, with generations preceding us?
I think so. I think history is just an integral part of who we are. And I think one of the wonderful things about Southerners is that we have a strong connection to that past, for better and for worse. And we know what it means to go through these incredibly difficult times and to have ancestors that we're not proud of or, on the flip side, to have ancestors that we are proud of that fought for, the really good things that have helped our community today. So I think we're always going to be aware of that and especially as a fiction writer, to portray that past honestly and not romanticize it is very important to me.
Well, once again, the book is The Story of Land and Sea from Katie Simpson Smith, and she will be at Maple Street Books in New Orleans next Wednesday the 3rd, and then the following day at Octavia Books at 513 Octavia Street in New Orleans. Katie, congratulations and good luck, and let's talk again.
Thank you so much.
Our pleasure. And we shall return tomorrow. Until then, for Frank Barnett, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.